Hello to all the listeners around the world. I hope you're all safe and sound and ready for a new episode of All is Blau. My name is Caroline Pala, and my guest today is Desizuava Bancheva from Sofia in the Bulgarian Republic. She is the current artist in residence in Esther Epstein's Messer Salon Embassy Zurich North, as well as the founder of Hip Hip Library in Sofia and founder of the Sofia Art Book Fair. Now, if you're into self-publishing, if you have a friend that is into self-publishing, you gotta listen to what Desizuava has to say. She's a real trooper in the field. She's been doing so much for the world of self-publishing in her region, but also beyond it. So I'm extremely happy that she was my guest here and shared some of her knowledge, some of her insights, and her approach to self-publishing. What makes her stick to it? We have no time to lose. So here she is, Desizuava Bancheva, All is Blau, number 12. Here we go. You have a really nice voice.
Thanks. Yeah.
I have not heard this type of voice before.
Good. Maybe also the vodka I drank last night helped to smooth it down.
No, yeah. I think there might be, there's something I think that probably comes from your mother tongue also.
Yeah, my voice is a bit particular. Also when I was growing up, it was always like lower. I also used to sing in a chorus, So I was doing it like really low line, the voices that are going.
That's like a really big thing in Bulgaria,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, because there's folk choirs. Yeah. So I think also this trained my voice for a while, because if you really practice this a lot, like this, it's really particular. It's like an exercise a lot for your voice.
And do people do that in school also, or did it was an extra?
No. I went to like a special school. It was a school with really a big emphasis on arts, and in general, one of the few schools that you could experiment, or like kids could get to know different kinds of arts in a really early stage. So apart from singing, there was all sorts of dancing, there was wood carving, there was painting, there was lots of musical instruments we could experiment with. So it was nice.
Do you remember, was it you who wished to go to such a school, or did your parents choose
it
for you?
No, it was not me. I think it was my parents at the time. And also this school, you needed to go through an IQ test to go into.
So, okay.
You're 7 years old and you need to do this test. It's like quite strange.
And did you score well?
Yeah.
Apparently,
otherwise you can't go. So...
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I've got three brothers.
And did they also attend that school?
No. I was the only one.
Are you the...
I'm the oldest.
The oldest.
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. And then they chose not to put your brothers in that same school.
Well, it's a strange thing because, you know, now that I'm a parent, I know that your life changes, and also the way you see the future of your kids might change. So maybe with me it was that time, and then something else happened in my parents' life, and they also got divorced when I was five. So kind of was like with my brothers it was different already, because I was the first one. They really cared and they wanted the best, like for me to go to the best schools and all these things. And I think after some time you realize that, like, you know, doesn't really make sense pushing so hard. Also, my brothers were obviously very not artistic. So they didn't, you know, for boys, I don't know, it was like kind of, if you see boys are into sports or more like they want to play and hang out, you don't send them to a school like that. Because my school, actually, I was picked up every morning at 6:30, I would walk out. Then there was the bus stop, which was just like 100 meters away from my house. By 9, we were at the school, so it went like around picking.
Yeah, that was a long, wow.
Yes, because the school was not in the city, it's outside the city. Mm-hmm. So the campus was out, And then it was like a whole day school. So I would come back home at 5. So from 6:30 to 5, you know, not everybody could pull this thing off. You stay there, okay, you have a lot of activities. It's outside, kind of in the nature. But I don't think my brothers were really up for that, you know. It takes like a bit of another kind of mentality and dedication. So I was happy, but for a limited time. Then this school became kind of really elitarian in a way. So that's what happens, actually. A lot of rich people started trying to send their kids there to also kind of to corrupt the system so they could go in even if they didn't pass the exams. And by the time I was in the seventh grade, I already didn't like it. Because then for me, you know, from being a place like a dream place where I could explore my creativity, it became like a little bit like a prison, like a social prison. Because you go with the bus, you're always with the same people, you're in this enclosed, like, environment. And I couldn't go like normal teenagers, let's say, just walk out of the school and go to cinema or to walk back home. You know, I was always connected with this transport. It was quite... Yeah,
and seventh grade, you're like 12 or 13.
Yeah, but already I was feeling like in a prison and I already started hearing this kind of phrases like, oh, do you know who his father is? Or do you know her mom? You know, she's in TV. And when I realized that, like, people rely to each other by who their parents were or, like, not who they are personally, I really got so frustrated. I wanted to get out. So then I failed because there's another exam after the seventh grade and the people that were there initially can easily continue. But I failed the exam on purpose.
So then you did high school in Sofia?
Yes, I did. I mean, I started in another high school afterwards, which was like kind of the complete opposite of that. So it was the school in my neighborhood where I lived. So I really wanted just to walk out and cross the road and be, you know, go to school.
Go to school independently.
Yeah, and that's what it happened. So I went into that school. It was quite a good school, but also very... different, yeah, in the hood. And it was kind of the time where in this neighborhood was not so easy to live. Like 90s in Bulgaria was a time when a lot of bad things started happening all of a sudden, you know, coming out of communism and being in a really isolated space, protected in a way from the Western influence, or not even Western, even from the East, you know, because actually what happened in the 90s is that a lot of drugs started coming through Bulgaria from Afghanistan, all the heroin. So it was like kind of all of a sudden all these things came in, porn, you know, pornography or in general sex and drugs and prostitution, like it just exploded in a way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I saw it growing up.
What about the war in Yugoslavia?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't really remember. My grandfather was a diplomat in Belgrade, so I know he was really affected.
Did he stay? Was he able to stay there, or did he have to come back?
No, he was not there. Of course. Yeah, no, of course.
No, because I imagine if there was like a raging war in Germany, I mean, I would be scared shitless.
It's very different. People in the Balkans are used to wars. Like, it's not the same. I think if something happens here in Switzerland, it's going to be so much more like an emotional and psychological impact for the people. Because they read, like, I think it's really such a safe place to be. It's so safe also for your mentality. It's like so easy to fall asleep and to be in this perfect... a system where you're taken care of, you know, you just pay your taxes and then forget about problems in a way, because we are used to wars. We are used to like just feeling that the war is right behind the corner. I mean, everything that happens in the Middle East as well, and Syria and
Turkey.
We see it through the people coming in. And then when you have such an immediate contact with people coming from a place of war, then you experience it more, like, you know, it's more real to you.
So do you feel that the refugees are more integrated than they are here?
I mean, I don't know what integrated means. I don't use these
terms.
Are
they visible?
Of course they're visible. There's like thousands of them, maybe, I don't know, maybe even a million. I'm not sure. Integrated, I don't know what it means. And also refugees, I don't know what it means. I just know that there's this all these people that are just running for their life. And it's really strange because I hear a lot of like judgmental kind of approaches to this problem when people say, okay, we've been to the Balkans, we saw how, you know, we saw the conditions in which the refugees live, like on the floor in this old factory, people are piled up and sleeping over each other. Yeah, but sorry, but Switzerland is one of the countries that let in the smallest number of refugees in the West. Like, you know, you can't judge us because through our border every day there's like thousands of people coming. Okay, maybe the border control is not so good, whatever the matter is, but these people are there. And so when they become kind of like such a big number, and obviously the Bulgarian government can't even take care of their own citizens. So this is not, it's not a matter of taking care of these people, but they're there and there's so many and we live with them. You know, for me, it's really normal to walk out and to see some people and then to talk to them and then say, oh, do you want me to bring some clothes to you tomorrow and arrange to meet somebody I never know to give them clothes for my kids or to, I don't know, just you see so many people in need and it's completely different. So this is like being really realizing what's the effect of the war, because once your country gets wiped out of the map, once you don't have anything that's yours, once your children are threatened with dying, like at the beginning of their life, this is a war. And then you run for your life and you go anywhere. And Bulgaria is not such a bad place to be, you know, or anywhere else.
I think what I meant is, because the war is going on for 5 years now. And
there's been a war for more than 5 years.
Yeah.
Always there. Since the Americans set foot in that region and started coming after the oil, there's been a war like for decades now. I mean, in different situations and shapes, and actually the war in Yugoslavia is kind of a milder version because the Serbians, they recovered, you know. It's a country that like could take care of itself, you know. Okay, you go to Belgrade, you see these buildings in the center like still with the holes from the bombs, you know, and it makes an impression. But then you look around and you see like it's a alive place. People are living and creating and they got over it, you know. But I don't think this can happen, let's say, in Syria or in Iraq, or, you know, it's not so easy for them just to, oh, let's get over it.
Yeah. What I was trying to ask when I said, are they integrated, is just if you can observe, I mean, people who have been there for several years, can they participate in civil life? I guess that was the question.
Of course. But this is also always a matter of who you are and how you do your life in general. You know, there's people that are hardly integrated in their own countries. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for instance, where my studio is, it's a really interesting area. It's like the old center where old Jews used to live in the 30s and 40s. So kind of really aristocratic it used to be. Now it's a little bit decadent because, a lot of the buildings are kind of almost derelict and just falling apart. And there's a lot of squats and also refugees living around that area. But there is this guy called Freddy. Freddy is from Iraq, and he opened right next to my studio a restaurant called Ashurbani Pao. And
what does it mean?
Actually, I don't know, to be honest. But I think it's maybe like a region or where he comes from, or Ashurbani Pao. But he's amazing. Like, he cooks there. It's really like a place that some people don't want to go to because it really feels like you're just visiting him, you know, all the plates, all the dishes, they're like different kinds of forks and knives, nothing fits, nothing is like, it looks almost like a little bit dodgy in a way, but he's amazing. He cooks like this interesting mixture of Mediterranean and also kind of Eastern and kind of exotic also dishes, and every day you just go there and he's got 5 meals and just serves on the table. There's a big table, people sit together. And this guy, okay, I know him for like, I don't know, 7 years now, 5, 7. So he's really well integrated. You know, he kind of became famous around this area and people going there. For instance, when I was organizing my festival last year, that's where we made like the dinner with all the guests.
The book fair or a different festival? The art book fair.
Yes. And so that's where I brought all my guests to have dinner.
Excellent.
So it was really kind of interesting to observe because, okay, some of them were this really high cultured and, you know, people coming from the Netherlands and, you know, somebody wearing a Yohji Yamamoto dress walks into that place. And it's really nice to observe from being like, oh, a little bit, what is happening? This is a bit dirty, or is it clean? And then just getting all this food in front of you, and he serves a soup, a lentil cream soup, but in a plastic cup, like a coffee cup. So you get this plastic cup of lentil soup, and you're like, okay, what's going on? And then people are just, and he comes out, and he talks to everybody, like he speaks Bulgarian, he speaks English, and he just starts being a host. And yeah, I think he's more integrated than a lot of Bulgarians I know. So there's also other examples, of course, but I don't think it's difficult to be integrated. In Bulgaria, it's probably much more easy to start doing something and to become something than maybe in Switzerland. Because actually, yes, the people that make it, or like the people that start having a normal life, they really need to do something. They can't be taken care of. There's nobody to take care of you. So this is the real integration for me, you know, like starting a business or doing something or meeting people or becoming local in a way. Otherwise, you can be integrated for many years, just getting the money from the social and what?
Yeah.
Are you really integrated? You live somewhere like in a dodgy place. You hardly go out. You hardly do the things that other people do. You hardly meet local people. This is not integrated for me. So I think there are people, but it's so many of them. There's no way they can all be that doing that well, you know?
Yeah, and a lot of people are traumatized.
Yes, and there's a lot of people that really don't want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So many people kind of ended up there because they couldn't make it to Western Europe. So the idea for them was to go to Germany or to Switzerland or, you know, anywhere just west. And they didn't make it that far. So they don't really want to be there because they want to be somewhere else. You know, the grass is always greener on the other side. No, it's not easy, especially with for the people with kids. That's really the big problem, because, you know, it's kind of an idea that you're in a transition phase, so they don't really think or know how long they're going to be there. Actually, I think only the people that realize, okay, I'm going to be staying here, this is for long term, then they start thinking in a different way. But most of them, they really, I don't know what they're hoping for. Maybe going back one day, maybe moving somewhere else. So with the kids, it's really important. You have a kid that's growing up and they need to go to school. They need to learn a language. They need to do something else. They can't just be refugee kids, you know, playing in a derelict playground in front of a factory. And so I think that's the problem, because there's going to be a generation of kids growing up in other countries. And these kids, you need to take care of them. And they need to learn the language. They need to, yeah, you know.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's that different if you're here or in Bulgaria. I don't know.
No, it's not that different. I mean, you're a fugitive, kind of. So you are pushed against your will to leave your country, to leave your family. That's also very common. So, like, some people, they really, like, left their brothers and sisters or their mom and dad because they were too old. They couldn't make the journey, you know, behind. So once you do that, doesn't matter where you end up, you know. You can even be in the next town, but it's just like you break with your roots. It's not like, okay, I went to study here and there and I traveled around and then I came back and my family was there for me, so I never really felt like I'm leaving anybody behind. But this is actually the biggest trauma comes from, yeah, knowing that you left people behind and knowing that you're actually doing okay compared to what they might be going through. But yeah. But also there is a lot of, I mean, just the same way that there's brainwashing and there's media influence on the other side. So, like, you know, us not being refugees, the way we, some people have stereotypes and there's a lot of crap coming from the media. Believe me, there's a lot of also brainwashing going on their side. So it's something that people rarely talk about, the kind of duality of the situation, because a lot of them also are brainwashed from, especially coming from all these NGOs and organizations like they're supposed to take care of them or support them. So I think this is something that they really need to take it easy sometimes, because they really give them such a hard time having all these expectations, or like showing them a reality which is actually not so real. And then once you see yourself as a victim, it's really hard to be integrated. That's also, you know, if you're victimized, you need to be taken care of. So if you're a victim, somebody needs to help you, and you're suffering and you're like stuck in this box.
You're passive.
Yes. So this is also another side of the coin. You know, I'm not like blind just saying, yeah, you know, we don't know what it is to be a refugee and da da da. But also a lot of these people actually struggle because of the expectations they have to receive support or, yeah. Anyway, being a victim is not a good position.
No, no.
Yeah, I mean, we can't see what they're going through, but I'm sure like soon our lives are also going to change dramatically. So maybe it's good to be in touch with that reality.
What are you referring to?
I'm referring to the shit hitting the fan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm referring to the world currently, like the major political powers in the world being, okay, America and China and let's say Russia, okay? So all these three are led by egomaniac, self-obsessed, self-absorbed retards. And this actually, okay, this is fine, you know, these people do exist, but it means like a majority of the population actually goes for that. And that's what you reflect yourself into your leaders. So if this is the reflection of the growing population of the earth, it's gonna be interesting what happens in the future. So I see, like, I don't know, Trump. What is Trump? What is this? This is something I can't explain. How did it happen? It's, you know. So, let's see.
The story you were telling about you bringing your friends or your guests from the art book fair to the restaurant that is hosted by the Iraqi men. It reminded me, you know, after the suicide of Anthony Bourdain, I don't know, did you watch his programs when he went? He would like travel
to
adventurous places.
Yes,
yes. And what I thought was interesting then after his death was what he said about how he would be much more generous, or he would cut much more slack to people in faraway countries. Like, for instance, he's somewhere in Southeast Asia, and he knows that his hosts are like maybe super homophobic. But still, as soon as there's food on the table, you have something that you can relate to. And I was listening to a podcast of an old talk with him from 2011, I think. And he said he wished that he could be in America and cut his people as much slack as he cuts other, you know, in his own country, he would be very judgmental as soon as he knows, okay, this is a Republican voter, or this is someone who has these ideals or whatever. He would like cut himself off and not even talk to that person. But then he goes to the Middle East, and he knows they're like super anti-Jewish, but still he can actually sit around the table with them and not get into that controversy. It's something that made me think of how am I in these situations? Am I also, I mean, I think I can observe that with me too here, that when I go away, I'm, for some reason, these people, they're, yeah, it's, maybe it's also because you kind of depend on them because you're a guest. You're a guest, you're on your own. And so you, yeah, you cut people a lot of slack because they're generous to you. They opened their homes to you. And so you might actually kind of just, you know, close an eye and be, okay, let's just not get into this. And here where I'm living, I'm just much more, okay, that's not my people.
It
just gave me something to think about.
Something about also traveling and being a foreigner in a stranger somewhere, because also this is one of the oldest, you know, notions, political or I don't know, sociological, you know, the notion of citizenship. So when you're a citizen and you feel that you're part of a community, so this is your, it can be your country, it can be your commune, it can be your underground movement, it can be your squat, you know, it can be your club, it can be your library, but you feel part of something. So then you are proactive, and then you really express your opinion, and then you're critical in a like constructive way, because you're there, you're gonna be there, you live there, you need to make a change, you feel part of something bigger. When you're traveling and when you're abroad or visiting or just being guests somewhere, it's a nice state of mind, because you're still judging, you're still critical in your thoughts, but there is this notion of like not being responsible for that place or for those people. So then then you really can cut the slack.
Yeah.
You know, and this is actually so nice. And for me also being here was quite kind of a similar experience, because it activated a lot of my critical thoughts about the world and about my life, about where we are right now. But then I know that the moment when I go back home, then I can process that, and then I can make something out of it. I'm not allowed to be judging or judgmental. Not allowed. I don't allow myself. I am allowed, and I don't want to be going in conflict. You know, you can't go somewhere and just start saying to people, "Hey, fuck! This is so shit. Your system sucks. You know, wake up. You know, this is their place. This is their life, you know, where do you come from? Nobody gives a shit of your opinion." So then you sit on the table and you share the food.
Yeah.
Or the drinks, you know. You watch the football game or pretend you're watching and you get drunk. And that's it. You don't express opinions, you know. Obviously, in the back of your mind, you may be thinking like, oh, this game, you know, it's so political. How can people say like football shouldn't be political? How can they judge somebody who made a sign of his lost non-existing country? Because this is all you've got left, like your symbolism. So once you try to take symbolism away from people, what do you leave them with? Like, are they robots? And or all about this kind of football slavery, which I believe it exists, or not only football, all sorts of big sports. You know, so many of these people, if they're not playing the game for this team, they won't be here.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not a game. It's not a joke. This is very political. So you can't. Normally.
So for the listeners, I'm just gonna say, you know, we're talking about the soccer game when Switzerland and Serbia were playing against one another. And three players showed the double eagle, made a hand sign, maybe more. I mean, but it was a huge, I mean, it was crazy, the comments in the
media. Exactly. Oh,
For two hours, I just read comments of people. It was crazy how much that generated.
I don't know.
Yesterday, on my way to watch the game, I read up a little about on the Bulgarian national team and I saw that they were fourth in 1994.
Yeah, in 94.
Do you remember that? You were eight.
Yeah, I remember that, of course.
That must have been great.
Stoichkov and Lechkov. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I never was so excited about this game, and also because I'm kind of brought up by a feminist, I think. So also being a feminist, I really dissociate from all these kind of masculine power play games, or like something to be dominant, to show that you're still a hunter.
Yeah.
You know, because for me, football is like the epiphany of that.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, also yesterday watching all the people going crazy after the game, and actually, for me, it's really interesting to observe that this is a time when, like, people really get their primal, people, men mostly, like, their primal instincts out.
Yeah, yeah.
And they become, like, animalistic in a way, you know?
Yeah, so yesterday morning, the front page of the free newspaper, the 20 Minute, was just a collage of photographs of Swiss soccer players that were like screaming like warriors and like, you know, flexing their muscles. Like, it's totally wartime.
Yeah, exactly.
Like wartime.
Exactly. Also, this is something I was just saying with just to a friend, that wars exist around us in so many shapes and forms. So football is kind of, it, you know, it's funny because I remember as a child growing up, and then my grandfather, he told me, like, this is a really good game because it brings people together. So, like, when two countries playing, like, it was kind of like a diplomatic event also, you know. There was a whole ritual about, like, learning about each other's countries. And then the game was over and then people would still get together and talk. I mean, he was a diplomat, so maybe he had another perspective. But still, I kind of had the idea that these team games, especially the ones where people are represented by their national teams, they were a way to connect and to meet, to go somewhere, like to play, to meet, you know, like a festival with sports. And then the last, the last 20 years, I've observed completely the opposite happening. And now it's to an extreme point with football. I just see it in another type of war, another type of power play, domination. Also, like, you know, you watch a game and then half of the time there is this cut shots of Putin sitting with I don't know who. And I mean, what is it about?
Mm.
Is it the game? Well, and so I think people just really need that kind of thing. You know, they need the emotions, they need to get out and to be wild. Also, kind of after these games happen, if the team wins, like last night, Switzerland, so then everything is allowed. Your excuse to do anything, it's kind of your ticket to go to wow land.
Absolutely.
And it's kind of a legal
yeah, it's
way
like a free
like,
pass.
Yeah, free pass, yeah, for one night or whatever.
So you were saying, you were saying that you didn't really grow up watching soccer because you grew up with your mom. And earlier you were saying that your parents divorced when you were five.
Yeah.
So you stayed with your mom.
Yeah, yeah. My mom.
Your brothers?
My mom and my one brother, my first, like, the brother came after me, Trifon. He's from my mom's first marriage, so we have the same, completely the same parents. And then my mom got a second husband. He was from Italy. And then my second brother came from that relationship. And actually my stepdad, he was watching a lot of sports, formula and football. But he was not, I mean, he was the kind of person that would just sit like that, cross his legs, smoke a cigarette, you know, drink a glass of wine and watch the game. Mm. It was completely another type of personality. He was very cultured. He was very sophisticated. So I never had like crazy football parties at home and men shouting and taking off their shirts. You know, he was really like observing the sport. You know, he was a sports lover. And so I never really
but
felt...
But was he from Italy?
Yes,
directly,
from Italy.
Or was he of Italian origin?
No, he was from Italy, from Genova.
Okay, so yeah. did you visit
yeah,
Genova with him?
Yeah, of course. I mean, he died... He got sick with cancer and he died when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
So then this was exactly after that happened, I moved to Brighton to study in the college. But yeah, I mean, his parents, they were alive till like a few years ago and we were visiting them regularly. And yeah, I don't know. It's like a normal family, you know?
Yeah.
Nothing was different between my dad and my dad's family and my second dad and his family. For me, it was family.
You just had two dads.
Yeah, yeah. One was more like a friend and the other one was really taking care of me. But yeah, I had two dads and I think it's a lucky chance.
So what brought you to Brighton?
I don't know, actually, what brought me. I mean, I don't know how things happen in life. You go, end up somewhere, but probably the fact that I didn't want to be in the system of schools that I saw in Bulgaria. So, okay, the English, like, educational system is really structured in a way that I can relate to. So after you turn 15, so after the primary school, you have a choice to have a profile. So like to restrict your knowledge and to choose and have like three or 4 years you can learn just certain things. And then with these things you learn, you go to university. So they don't have the whole basic.
Yeah. But it's crazy that you're, because I mean, I remember when I was 12, I had to choose which high school I go to. And I mean, my parents, they didn't give a shit which one I wanted to go to. I just had to go to the closest one.
That was also
a state school.
Well, I think it was also coming from my stepdad because while he was still alive, he could see that I'm kind of an anti-establishment person.
Mm-hmm.
So he could also see that I was going through like a crisis in terms of losing the authorities, mm-hmm. and like starting to really not respect my teachers, mm-hmm. or in general the process of learning. So this is very dangerous, you know. If you lose touch with curiosity and with you know, the drive for having new knowledge, so then this can happen in school. Actually, this can be the worst thing that happens to you.
I know.
Yeah, you can really cut your connection to the world. And so I think he sensed that in a way, so then kind of was supportive for my idea to go elsewhere to study. But also when he passed away for my mom, like she was in this dark space, you know, and I don't think she even realized what was happening, that I was going there, you know. Her 14 years old daughter was like going to live elsewhere. So actually the years after, was a process of healing for my mom and for my family, but I also felt like so guilty in a way. Maybe that's like the closest I could relate to the refugees, because I knew my family is like falling apart and my mom is suffering and my brothers were still there, you know, and I was elsewhere and I was actually enjoying myself mm-hmm. or starting to have a taste for life, for amazing things, you know. So it was kind of a mixed experience with happiness and sadness.
Yeah, because your brothers were super young.
Yeah, they were super young and also kind of, I don't know, sometimes I feel like I should have stayed to take care of them and to help my mom. But I just, it was arranged, you know, it was all set. So I just went and mm-hmm. did what mm-hmm. I was expected to do. And yeah.
So that was high school in Brighton?
Yeah.
Or like a pre-college?
It's pre-college. It's called, I mean, what I did was A-levels. So it's actually, it was 3 years. And it's like very specialized kind of school that you go through. And then only with the things that you've studied. So, for instance, I was doing history of arts, graphic design, photography, international politics and British literature. So these were my choices. So I could only apply to university with something related or to some kind of program that, you know, these were on the list.
Yeah.
So I can't, I mean, obviously you go through this preparation, you can't apply to
chemistry.
Chemistry, yeah. You can't.
Yeah.
Because actually...
Makes sense.
Actually, you don't go through an extra test to go to the university. Mm-hmm. You just get your scores from the past year. So obviously, yeah, this is what happens. I mean... School is one of the worst things that can happen to a child.
Yeah, school is fucked
up. Yeah,
school is, I mean, I think even earlier than school, I just, you know, I've started this work where I'm photographing baby girls and I'm just trying to, I mean, the reason why I started doing this is because I was so shocked when you Google girls, you just find images of completely sexualized girls. So I just want to find an imagery that is not so, even not sexualized, of course not, but also that is not so gender technically charged, not so charged with gender. And at this really early age, it's the easiest, I feel like. But still, then you see how the girls get dressed. And I mean, I say they get dressed because they don't dress themselves yet at that age. And then I feel that it's so much violence to do to a child, to just press it in that gender costume that they have to wear. And all of this, I mean, it makes me physically feel awkward. It's crazy. And then, of course, with school, it's like amplified. And
yeah, yeah. It's really so much, so much. And it's really so funny that you go through all this shit and dressing up or making up and learning or trying to fit in a box, in a frame. And then all this you do just to realize who you are at the end. Mm. So like just to go back to yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. It could be like so easy just to be yourself the whole time and not go through this shit and try to be like 1,000 other people.
Did you go through different phases?
Oh yeah, of course. I'm still going.
Okay, what's the phase right now?
I'm a very like morphy kind of person. I don't know what's the phase, but just I feel like I'm constant. Like you know when people say when you're on drugs, like mm-hmm. you when you're high, and you say you feel that you can sense your hair growing.
Mm-hmm.
So I have this feeling constantly, like not only about my hair, but just about everything, about my emotions, about my body, and everything is like, I feel it's moving, it's mm-hmm. changing. So I'm not really constant. I mean, in a way, I have my constitution and the things that I really stick to, which are my core. But around that core, there's everything is in constant evolution, or let's say transformation. I already got used to it, so not having this like staticity or like feeling that you're grown up or that you're, you know, that you know yourself so well. Because sometimes I surprise myself, like what things I do or things that come up to my mind. It's like another person coming from nowhere. But for other people to be around me, it can be confusing and unsettling, because generally I think people are, they're not so happy with changes, or especially later in their life, you know, when you're young, you're more adventurous and
it's more part of it also.
Yeah. But after later in life, it becomes kind of unsettling to have this woman around you that constantly
who is that?
Yeah, but for me it's fine. It's also a way not to be bored, because one of my worst fears is apathy and boredom. So like when I start just remotely feeling that I'm getting bored, I reinvent the situation, and I hate routine. So
so before we start talking about what you're doing now, all your personal investment and your activity in the self-publishing world, let's maybe go back to after you graduated in Brighton. You went on to study photography in Milan.
Yes.
Did you go back home to Sofia first, or?
Oh, well, briefly, briefly. But I didn't take a break or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just went straight to my next stage.
So was the choice to go to Italy, was it probably influenced also by your stepdad?
Maybe, but also it was influenced from living in Britain for 3 years. It was definitely not my thing.
Okay.
I mean, there was a lot of good things happening, a lot of, learning and experience and really rich culture, and musically, like, this opened my mind so much because, yeah, Britain is really a rich place for concerts, for bands. You know, it's like such a long conversation we can have about that. But from another point of view, I really didn't feel like this is my place or this is the life I want to have. I didn't like the climate. I didn't like the food. So I'm a very easygoing person, but one thing I really care is my food. I really want to have good food and to be able to experience it in a nice way. So in England, I felt really like deprived of my basic human rights to have sunshine and, you know, good food. So Italy for me was kind of a, because obviously my stepdad, so I knew Italian perfectly. And also because I knew a lot about the culture already. And also because it's really close to, you know, kind of this Mediterranean, like also very close to the Balkans in a way. The mentality of certain people, especially in the south of Italy. So for me, it was more like going to a familiar place, you know. Mm. And of course, I was like, once you get into this learning process and your curiosity about the world, and then you want to learn more and you want to go elsewhere, you want to see other places. And so this was also a drive, you know. I didn't want to go back home.
So did you produce work in Milan?
Yeah.
What kind of work?
Well, actually I graduated in photography, but with video. Mm-hmm. So I mean the last year of being there, after I got through this like very traditional in a way course, so dark room and still life and all the practicalities and technicals, and I was really into it. But then I had a chance to also experiment with video, which was not, you know, it was not meant to be actually so important for me, but it became. So this is when I realized I'm so related also to sound and to motion, to movement, and I also wanted to learn the techniques. So for me it was also like a challenge. I said, okay, yeah, I can do a really nice exhibition and take photos, you know, and graduate, but I could also just push my limits for 1 year. So the last year I just decided I want to do a video, which was okay, you know.
So what was it about?
Well, it was about this, it was a short, really short kind of experimental movie. It was about this how you call them, like insects that go through a phase of coming out of the cocoon and like metamorphosis, and then they come out. And actually we shot it in Bulgaria on a lake, so we made like a floating platform of wood, and on that platform my friend who's dancer and performer, she was performing this kind of ritual of coming out of her body and becoming something else. And I made like a special costume, which was this a kind of Michelin looking costume with wire and like a white structure that looked really like a big white worm, you know, in the distance in the lake. And then I also made some sound to go with it. So it was like a narrative with my voice, a little bit broken with sound. And it was the story of this butterfly or whatever. So it was really, I mean, actually I was quite shocked that everybody liked it so much, because I didn't know, it was like I was not expecting to be good or do something special. And then when I showed it my school, like people were very happy with it. And I was also happy, but then I lost interest. Like I didn't want to do this anymore. It was kind of, I don't know, like,
yeah,
I just wanted to do that.
Yeah, now that you know how it's done, then it's not so interesting anymore.
It's different because with photography, for instance, and with graphics, I still practice it a lot and I reinvent it. But with this, I guess it was also my way of, like, growing out of this phase. So just to combine, because I had so much influence from visual point of view, from musical point of view, from the things I've been reading, and then also switching languages all the time. So this kind of, I couldn't just express that in a photograph or something two-dimensional in a way. So I needed to put everything into one, and this is what really video can allow you to do. You know, you can build things, you can make things, you can record and have your voice, and it was nice.
So where did you catch the self-publishing bug?
I actually caught it later when I was already back in Sofia, after living in Italy for an extra year after my graduation. And I was trying to do some commercial work, so working as a photographer for a newspaper and / magazine, mostly making portraits of supposedly interesting people. Yeah, this didn't work for me. Firstly, because the money was ridiculous, so that was really not well paid. Second, because I wanted and I tried to use only analog. So for me, it was like a process, and then they were impatient. Obviously, you need to deliver something on time, and this is almost impossible. But yeah, this also taught me in a way that I can't be part of this fast culture thing. You know, yeah, I could take digital photos. You know, I also take them now with my phone. But and then I decided just to quit that, and I started working and helping out my mom with the family business, actually, that my stepfather had started. And then I could earn money in that way, doing something which is, let's say, not really what I imagined myself doing, but because you're doing it for your family, it's kind of like it motivates you in a different way. But also I learned about business, and I learned...
That was the clothing
business.
Yes,
yes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, after, like, several years, I became the manager of the company, and then I learned about everything that is behind the business, which is a lot, you know, the paperwork, the employees, everything related to that, the fact that, you know, you need to be kind of create a structure and take care of it. Then I could do something on the side, which was more what, like, I would like to do. So I opened my first studio. slash gallery slash residency slash the place I lived in. And then 1 year, almost even not a year, half a year later, I met these two girls. They were also Bulgarian, Rossi and Raya, and they were actually like already starting and doing like something like a self-publishing project called Blood Becomes Water. Because, yeah, you know this saying, blood is thicker than water. Mm-hmm. We have a saying, Кръвта вода не става, which means blood doesn't become water. And their their idea is that blood becomes water. Anyway, so they were doing this like self curated editions where they would invite artists to interpret like a topic. So every issue would have a theme, which were quite interestingly formulated, the topics of these magazines. Let's say magazines, they're not really. And then they would invite artists that some of them they never met, just write an email to somebody they've seen their work on the internet and say, hey, do you want to take part in our next project?
But was that international or national?
Yes, it was international, very international. Actually, in some of their publications, there's some really good and now kind of emerging artists that maybe at the time were just part of an underground or, also, a lot of their work is driven by music, so it's very kind of like rock and roll oriented. The aesthetics as well and the selection of the people. And yeah, so I kind of really connected with them. We had a lot of things in common. And at the time I was curating shows at the studio, so anything really, I was experimenting, what I can do or how I can push the limits of the space, and from performance to photography to like mapping, video mapping, and some experimental musical stuff. We had parties, we had concerts, anything. And one day there was like a really strange space, a little bit like the room we're in, so a little corner, almost like you had to bend over to get into that space. It was like a square inside of a square, really strange. And we never figured out how to use it. And then one day...
it's like the 8.5 floor in Being John Malkovich.
Yes, it's something like that. So just a non-space in the space, nobody could really use it. It was not visible. When you do a show, you don't want to put something in there because people need to go... almost like bending over to enter, and then it's small and it's lower. And then Raya just said, oh, this is so perfect for a little library. Let's bring some of our books here. Everybody had their own collection. And they had their books as well. So we said like, yeah, let's do that. And we made some shelves, filled the whole little box with bookshelves. And then we just brought our stuff in and we realized like it's half empty, it's too many shelves and not enough books. And and then we just said, okay, let's start a library, people can bring more books, and then we fill these shelves because now it's not looking complete. And we made like an open call, so we decided we're going to organize this thing and make an open call on the internet to collect this kind of artist books. And also there was nothing like that in Bulgaria. And still there isn't, I think. We were the only people doing that. So it was kind of exciting and people were really interested and everybody started coming so much for these books that like they didn't really care about the show or if there was a performance, It was always everybody, like when you go to a party, people always tend to crowd the kitchen.
Yeah.
There is a huge living room and there's like amazing music or whatever, records and books, and nobody cares. People just stay in this small kitchen. So the same thing happened with the library. And then we realized actually this space, it's like dysfunctional now, because the rest of the gallery was like really high ceilings and kind of standard space for for displaying art, but we just needed something more private, you know, for all these books to be collected and presented. And so for kind of 2 years, we were receiving a lot of also contributions to the library from artists, which have found the open call. And yeah, in the world of artist books, there's a big like network, so people share and talk. So, you know, sometimes you don't know the person live, you haven't seen that person, but you feel like you know each other, you write each other emails, you share each other's work, you support that person. And then eventually, maybe after 10 years, you can meet them and say like, hey, yeah, yeah. Where have you been? And so it happened really organically.
But all the while you were still working as a manager.
Yes, all the while, of course.
With the family business.
I couldn't afford it otherwise. And actually, that's what happened when I got pregnant with my daughter, Vivian. So then I had to stop working. I realized at one point, I mean, very late, but... So, I mean, there is always a point when you say, okay, I need to slow down, or like, I can't be doing this. I can't do 100 things. And I also wanted to enjoy it, you know, because I might not look or strike you as the person that really enjoys these moments in life. But then I said, like, I'm having a baby, you know, it's like a beautiful thing. I cannot go back in that time. So I realized that and I decided I don't want to be stressing or thinking about other things. So then I left the gallery.
To them? To Rosie and...
No. Rosie and Raya, we just kind of started this together, but Raya, shortly after, she went to live in Brussels, and Rosie stayed in Sofia, but started more like being interested in organizing concerts and bringing in rock and roll bands. So I couldn't leave it to anybody. I just left, you know, I took out my stuff and I left the space, which I was renting, of course. Which was like really strange feeling. I guess that's when I realized, I felt like, okay, does it look like a defeat or something? Because I invested so much and I put like all my energy and emotions into this place. And then all of a sudden I had to just leave it. It didn't feel right, but also I knew if I kept it, I needed to, you know, to make sense of having it. So then I would have to worry or to do extra work, which I couldn't physically manage.
So you put the books in storage?
Yes, I put the books in storage and then I had my baby, and it was a very nice time just to detach myself also from my life and what I was doing, and to rethink it, because it was actually getting a little bit chaotic, like too much, too many things happening. I was like frenetic, you know, I realized I'm good at doing a lot of things, so I also started, I mean, a lot of things in that aspect. So I also got into music, DJing and organizing things and parties and events and shows, and it was like very hectic time. So then I completely cut out also my connection to the world, because I'm very sociable. So at one point I just like went into asylum for a time, you know, with my baby, just walking around and being in nature.
But you lived with the baby's father?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. Yeah, at that time, yeah. And so it was really nice. And afterwards, when I gathered my strength, you know, I kind of got back into being myself. I just realized that I just wanted continue with the books, you know, this is my thing, this is what, it really made so much sense, because I, you know, coming from such a mixed kind of background and also having all these various interests, it's just something that puts everything into a frame, but also it like contains the possibility of anything being presented in that format. So also I could continue being in touch and working with various artists. But then it could also be something more, like, specific. So I don't spread myself all over the place. Because I don't believe people can be good at everything, you know, or like this kind of one-man band, you know. I think, yes, you should stick to your thing and just do that to be really good and excellent. So I decided I would just work with books. And shortly after, I also realized that I was creating like a movement in a way, because there was nothing like that in Bulgaria, in Sofia. So I started being in touch with a lot of young artists, and I saw that it's really important for me to also be more like an educator in a way, because it gives them a lot of perspective about their work, especially nowadays, you know, going to art school and becoming an artist. It's really like one of the most unsettling things that a young person can do, because you're doomed, or you know that you gotta be making sacrifices and you're not doing something which financially promises you that you'll be okay. So this kind of gave me the idea to start organizing workshops, inviting people to talk about their work or how they ended up doing these books, why is it important, why it's important to have like a real network and to connect with people physically, also to present your work physically, not just a website or some kind of luminous screen. And
what makes us stick to the analog stuff like that? It's sometimes I think about it.
Yeah, it's yeah, some people,
because you were just saying you're telling the young artists that it's really important that they make this, and that they physically make it, and that they actually are present with their body to present it to people. So what did you tell them?
I don't know. I don't really formulate it like in one sentence, but I guess just being around me and seeing that. I think the most inspiring thing probably is just being and doing. So I just surround myself with really interesting people, and I have so many friends which are actually real in the terms that we have this common passion, and I spend a lot of time like talking and thinking and making books, and so it really makes me happy. So it's one of the things, to be happy and also to be connected with like real people. So something which is not entirely ego related. It's a little bit like I guess what people have about team sports, you know. So in the art world, which is completely becoming like ego driven and money driven and completely about
winner takes projection. It all.
Yeah. Also, it's very political nowadays because of all the agendas that the different governments and organizations push forward. So it's also subsidized by institutions. I mean, there's a lot of things behind that. I don't want to go into that. You know, I'm a very political person, so I always see these things. I mean, I don't believe in this like art, you know, it's detached from the real world. And actually, we are so affected by politics all the time. So the books is kind of a democratic way of, like, doing work, also presenting it, also distributing it, also sharing it, and also making it possible that people can participate in the art market. Because it's really the connection between normal people and the artists. Not everybody can afford an original artwork.
Yeah.
And this is very, like, I don't know, in a way I find it quite noble, you know, for an artist. Because to produce a book, it takes a lot of time. Obviously, it's a really, like, a process, and it's a lot of efforts. And quite often, you don't even break even. Like, you don't even go to zero from perspective of what you invested and the money you put into printing. I'm talking about self-publishing, of course. So then it's really giving out something to others, which is mostly why I think it's important, because it helps you like cure your, I think artists have a common like ego issue at, you know, at one point. It's all about you, your art, the way you see the world. And I was just the other day, I went to an Andreas Just library in Alpenhof, and I was looking at this book of a South American artist, a female artist. I can't remember the name now, but there was this quote that struck me. It said, it was a letter she wrote to her lover. And she said, in love, I also need you. In my art, I don't need you. I can be on my own. So it's really, actually, that's what it is, you know. And then she continued, so art is independence, so is masturbation. So kind of this funny metaphor, and this is what it's art. Sometimes it's like masturbating, you know, with the world happening around you. So you're just enjoying yourself and pushing the buttons. But yeah, to make the books, it's also thinking about the response of others. And so, you know, they're going to be out there, and thinking about also what kind of audience you have, you know, physically constructing something. So thinking about paper, the ink, about the colors, about the smell, about the thickness, about all the physicality. So this makes, it's kind of a meditation, I find, you know. So then you get abstracted a little bit more from your work and what you created as an egocentric artist, and then you make this other thing, you know. So books are really great for generally, also because there's this the ongoing question about the death of print and so on and so on. Of course, there's also like somebody's agenda behind that. We know that it's not going to happen. Obviously, in the global market of books, it's a big crisis. So people tend to read less and less. And I think that with the future generation, probably books, like standard books, will be almost extinct. So also these artist books are kind of saving the format.
So tell me how, you know, the transition from, I mean, when you had your daughter, Valeria?
Oh, Vivian.
Vivian.
Yes.
So when you had Vivian, you put the books in storage, and then how did you end up opening Hip Hip Library, which is also a store?
Well, actually, she was two, I think, two. So I couldn't stand it anymore that, like, I was keeping all these books, like, in boxes, in a basement kind of storage. And I really got this impulse, like, to restart my social life and to do something new, you know. Also by being in the business with my mom, I really felt like I could start like a business, you know, because the books were never a business and they should not be a business for me, I think. And so I opened this bar. I was just walking down the road and very close to where we live, I wanted to find actually a space for a library. And I just saw this guy putting up a sign that this place was up for rent. And I opened the door and went inside. It was tiny, like 15 square meters. And a really steep ladder would take you downstairs where there was just a bathroom and a small storage. And I just said, like, what is this place? And he said, well, it's a bar, you know, it used to be a bar. I said, okay, I'm taking it. So then, because this is another thing. So I just got this space because I really liked it. And then I had to reinvent how the books could coexist with the bar. Because the bar was a bar. People were there drinking, coming with pizza fingers.
And it's also usually pretty dark.
No, yeah, it was dark. Oh. During the day, no, it was really like large glass vitrines. So it's kind of on the road, you know, you see from inside, outside. So during the day it was pretty light. But yeah, at night, obviously, it's a bar atmosphere. So then I started curating my selection. So the things that I would take to the bar would be specifically chosen for, let's say, also to put people in a certain mood or to make a statement. So sometimes I would completely just put some politically related zines or things to do with I don't know, something that was happening around in the city. So this little display collection, because it was very tiny where the space I could display the books, it was constantly changing. So from my bigger library, I would just take out little pieces and show them and then take them back in. And actually it became really nice place to hang out. So a lot of people were actually much more into the books when they were in the bar. Some of these people I've never seen coming to my library or to my gallery. Also, I learned a lot about nightclubs and the business behind the bar, because having a bar is a lot like totally different to having a business with clothes. It's another dynamics, different kind of things, you know, you need to know paperworks and yeah, a lot of things.
Did you bartend yourself?
I also bartended, yeah. And then a girl came to work for me. She was studying in the academy, the art academy. Martina Vacheva is her name. And she just started making these drawings for little books while working at the bar. And now she's actually quite a good, like, starting to become really famous kind of artist. And she really got into that through working at the bar, you know, being surrounded with these books and just, and then a whole kind of vibe of this kind of people coming there, artists, like drawing, drinking, you know, chilling at the bar. It became like really a circle. So from there, I had my son and I decided I can't keep up with with the bar and my daughter and like being, you know, having to go late at night. And
So you got pregnant the second time, yes, while you had the bar?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And then just the last person I worked there with, really nice girl, Daniela, I just told her, like, do you want to take the business? Because I could see that she's, like, entrepreneurial, you know. She wanted to do something more than just being a bartender. And I really just wanted to keep this place so I could still feel it's my own and I could still meet my friends there. And so I, like, just sold her the business, for, like, for nothing, you know. Everything I did and the space and the company. And so she took over. And now I'm still going there. It's my favorite place, you know. It's,
what is it called?
A Doom. Now it's called Doom. So yeah, it kept the spirit.
So you're invited in Zurich at Esther Epstein's Messer Salon Embassy, Zurich North, with a hip library.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's really a continuation of,
yeah, it's really being here, you know. Being here and being myself. And yeah, I'm showing some of the books. So again, a little bit like with the bar. So I was challenged to make a selection because my library is quite big. So more than 500 books. And obviously I can't just dislocate that.
But does the hip library in Sofia have a location?
Yeah, it does. It does. Now, like since a year, we've moved to a new location, which is probably where we're going to stay. It's also like more like a studio, but library, and we have some printing space there. So
there's production happening.
Yeah, there's also there's always a lot of things happening. Some production, some people looking at books, some people trying to work, some people listening to music. It's quite an active space, but it's good. And I think it's nice place to work and to meet people. It feels very right.
So how did you choose what you're going to bring to Switzerland?
I don't know. I guess just also by my egocentric drive. So I just brought the things I really like to currently, because it's also my taste is mutating and changing. So the things I'm interested in currently, or the things which I thought would open to a conversation that I would be interested in having, and that's how I selected them. When I came, I realized that some things were missing, and so I I organized for some extra books to be shipped later, because I knew, like, okay, I need this and this, and now I see the people and I know what kind of things are going to be interesting for them. So it was also second selection afterwards.
So the library is in the co-op, Meralswohnen.
Yes.
And you decided to open it up? Was it every Wednesday? Or?
Yeah, it was actually... I was there more than everywhere. This was just the official times. But I'm a very present person. So like people, once they saw me that I'm there, and when the door was open, they would walk in. And it was really nice. Actually, there it's such a small kind of community, you know, around this commune that just... you connect with people in a more organic way. Like, let's say if the library was in Langstrasse or something, I would not have this kind of bonding, I guess, with people. It would be maybe ongoing, coming in and going out, like a lot of people coming, but I don't think it would be more quality, the connection. So I'm actually very happy to be there and also to experience the life, like the normal life of these people, everyday normal people, you know. Otherwise, it's just being a tourist.
Yeah, so you see them during the, maybe either the first few hours or the last few hours of their day when they come
home.
Yeah,
actually, a lot of people there are families with small children. So a lot of the time, one of the parents is going around with the kids, taking care of them. And so there is life also in between these mm-hmm. working hours. Mm-hmm. And it's really like a lively place, you know. People use the space. There is a lot of public space there, and people talk. It's really nice. It's very sociable. And... the challenge was to make people come from Zurich, like from the center to that place. Okay, obviously I connected with people and I found a lot of friends, but, you know, it was also like to try to make them interested in me personally as a person and then come to visit me, and not to push them like, you know, this is my project, come to see my books. Actually, books are nothing without the people behind them. So is anything, you know. And then people started coming to visit me. And it was very organic. But this is also how I generally do things. I don't want to push things. I don't want to imply to people that they need to be interested in this. Or, you know, it's very organic. You either just get into it or you don't get into it. So some people would come and visit me and don't even look at the books. Just drink a beer and have a talk. It's fine. And then they would leave.
But today, can you sustain yourself from... because you were working in the family business, and then you had the bar, and now can you sustain yourself from the library?
Not really. Actually, now I'm just starting to visualize like ways, and I'm projecting. Because this is so difficult for me. Okay, so firstly, I have the financial kind of stability. Okay, let's say that I won't be left, or my kids, you know, we are fine. Their father is supporting them, and I don't need to really stress about that. So that's making things different for me. So now I'm making plans, and I have some ideas how to make money as well, but I don't want to make money with this activity. So for me also the shop, it kind of started just because people wanted to leave their books and people wanted to buy books, not because I wanted to sell books. And I don't take any profit in doing so. You know, you walk in, you buy the book, then all the money goes to the artist.
Wow.
Yes. So I'm not a distributor. I'm not a commercial bookseller. It's just a way, okay, democratically, you want to have this book, okay, pay and get it. And I realized I can't be doing this. I can't be pushing to be commercially selling. Then it changes the whole perspective for me. And also I become just like a dealer. And then the people that I meet, the artists, they become just, I don't know, producers for me, you know, somebody to get stock from, you know. And I don't want to go in that perspective. So mostly what I'm doing now, I mean, the past few years, I write projects. So with the festival or with other things I'm doing, I register the foundation. So I write projects and I apply for funding for these projects. And then when I get the funding, I have like a job for, let's say, 7 months when I'm organizing the festival. Mm-hmm. I'm paying myself through that money. So kind of, looking for interesting applications and costs and so on. And with the festival, actually, I could sustain myself in a way that it's it makes sense. But it's really a lot of work. It's so difficult.
Like, you started it last year, right?
Actually, 2 years ago, I did the first event, which was not called Sofia Art Book Fair at the time. It was more like underground and experimental. I didn't know what would happen. So it was really big success. And then from there, I kind of decided to make it a little bit more structured and more, not so underground, because, I love to stay underground, but it's not how you get to people mostly. And then Sofia Art Book Fair happened. Obviously, it was a lot of organizing, and this is really good. I mean, my knowledge about also business and managing and how to make a project, it is a lot of business in that. It's not just, I have this great idea. I have so many friends that are artists with books. Let's invite them. It's like a huge amount of organization and of preparation. So all the years that I was doing these weird jobs, I thought they were weird, actually it nothing is wasted, your experience, it comes into use. So now I realized that I could do some ongoing projects like that to also sustain myself. And then I would like to do something more oriented towards, let's say, an educational project. So to give something to students or to art students or anybody, actually, that I was missing at the time when I lived in Bulgaria. So like an alternative, extra, extra source of knowledge. And that's now something I'm thinking about. So organizing like a platform for artists or publishers or anybody actually interested in coming to Sofia, so people can come and share knowledge with students or whoever, and then host them like a residency, but for teachers.
I'm applying.
Yeah, so this is my idea now to start this project, and I think it could really work well. And
everybody who is a resident artist at Esther's produces a zine in the end.
Mm-hmm.
What are you planning to do, or have you done it, or is it already in production?
I'm doing it now, actually. I mean, I started doing it a few weeks ago, kind of having ideas. The thing is that I really have so much material, let's say, and also my experience here has been very multifaceted. So at the end, I'm actually working now on 4 different zines, but only one is going to be like the official one produced by the residency. But the others are just like different aspects of my experience here. So I just had this idea, and it's been since the beginning that actually, what am I here? For people, I'm like a tourist, it's because I come here for like 3 months, and I'm this, person like free of... I'm floating around, I'm flexible, I don't have a
schedule.
Strict schedule, yes. Yeah. So this makes it very romantic also, in a way, for people to be observing and to be around me, because I can be free and I can be spontaneous. So this is really like being a tourist. And on the other hand, I'm also kind of advertising, or let's say I'm representing my country. So a lot of
You're an ambassador.
Place. Yes, kind of I am. But, a lot of people have no idea about Bulgaria. And some of them just say, you're the first Bulgarian person I meet. So then I'm also kind of an agent. So I just said, okay, let's call this thing Balkan Tourist. So Balkan Tourist is the oldest existing touristic agency that was founded in during communism in Bulgaria. It still operates. But it's really funny because when you say Balkan tourists to anybody coming from the Balkans, like, they really associate it with this kind of decadent, trashy hotels, you know, because it's not the best agency, but it still works and it's got all the connections with these weird hotels, like, I don't know, like communist style architecture. Nothing has changed inside. The interiors are like untouched from the 60s, you know.
Wow.
So I'm making this zine now, which is gonna be called Balkan Tourist, and it's me being a tourist here, but also me showing what it's like to be where I'm coming from. That's funny. Just a game, but actually that's what I'm doing here as well, you know. This is the idea. So first step is to bring people to the library in Oerlikon. Second step is to bring them to Sofia.
Hey, thank you so much for coming, for taking the time, for thanks being for, so open.
Thanks for inviting me and waiting for me 2 hours. Jesus. But today was extreme.